so much. It's so lovely. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Ah, I'm just thrilled to be here, and thank you so much for reading my book. Thank you so much for inviting me here. I'm going to talk today, I'm just going to sort of talk to you about my spiritual ideas and my spiritual sort of journey since the book has been over. But before I started, I wanted to I want to remind everybody today that today is actually the anniversary of Rosa Parks's, it was December 1st, 1955, where she refused to give her seat up on the bus. And I feel like it's important to remember that every year. She is so inspirational to me. And I always love that when the police came to take her off the bus and told her she couldn't have her seat, she said, "You may do that. You may arrest me." May rather than can, which moved her from the victim to the actual protester. And the civil rights movement has something that's been so inspiring to me my whole life, and I constantly am reading about it. And when I was trying to show my daughter different religious traditions, we would do Christianity, Buddhism, we would do Islam, and then we would do the heroes of the civil rights movement. She would always like those the best because they were so the stories were so amazing and they seemed so much more closer to her. And I also find it, I read somewhere that someone on the bus when Rosa Parks was doing her, her incredible holy act, they said that it was like a mosque, and mosque inside, it was so quiet. And I always think of that she was able to make a church. She didn't even need to have a church to make a church, right? Just with her act. To me, that is so inspirational, And also the fact that desegregation is, it's a political and a legal thing, but I live in New York City. I live in we have every kind of class and race in our neighborhood. And I'm constantly reminded that, the ongoing work of, integration is actually a work of the Holy Spirit. I mean, that's not a legal thing. And I find that to be alive still in my life. And I think it's something to really remember. So I wanted to remember her today before I started, since she's such an incredible person. Amen, oh, I love that. I don't think I've ever had an amen before. Wow. Okay, so my talk today will be about my own relationship to God and to holiness. And my own relationship to God has been defined by restlessness, by doubt, by a very passionate inquiry. It hasn't at all been smooth. I'm not the kind of person, you read my book, I could never join a church and just sort of stay and listen to the dogma and the songs. I've enjoyed a lot of my church life, but my main religious life has been being sort of like a armchair theologian. I've been wanting to discover some of these things myself firsthand. Though I've definitely have felt the divine mystery in my own life, and not necessarily for good or for bad. I'm not one of those people that think that once you sort of fall in the stream of believing in God and you have a religious life that everything becomes good. I don't think that's true at all. I think sometimes your life can really kind of go to shit, actually. I think it can be really bad because you have to deal with yourself up front, right? You have to really start dealing with yourself. And that's not necessarily a positive thing. So I have felt like a lot of grace in my life, but it hasn't necessarily been happy, like a happy thing. It's been just more like a really powerful and energetic and amazing thing, sort of like science fiction, really amazing and weird, not necessarily happy. So I think that's the thing that I really, my own search has been really defined by that. And I do find that it's in the, to me, God is very, it's not knowable. It's a constant sort of, it's a joy, but also a chore and also painful to be longing all the time for this thing that you can never really know, right? But then that in a way is the mystery that's at the very source of all of our lives, I feel like. It's at the very center of mine, I know that. The idea of feeling something divine, but never really being able to get a hold of it completely. And a lot of my search has to do with my writing life. Like, I know you read about my friend, Sister Leslie, in my book, a lot of you, and she's such a wonderful nun. She's an Episcopal nun friend of mine. And I'll always say to her, I'll talk to her about my problems in my writing life, and she'll say, "Darcy, we've been through this before. Your writing life is your religious life. It is your spiritual life. Don't try to separate them." I've gotten to that point where I feel like my writing life and my prayer life are so close together, my religious life. And as a novelist, like a lot of the way that I approach religion has to do with writing. And I got this great quote that I really thought, you know, by the Nobel Prize winner, Orhan Pamuk. I wanted to read it to you because it really sort of shows how I feel about the mystery of, you know, how the mystery of God resides right in the middle of life and narrative. The modern secular individual, despite recognizing deep down the futility of his efforts, cannot help reflecting on the meaning of life as he tries to locate the center of the novel he is reading. For in seeking their center, he is seeking the center of his own life and that of the world. I think that's, you know, when you teach writing, it's so tricky because you want, like, there to be focus, thematic focus and whatnot, but you always want to respect the mystery as well. That mystery can't be, you know, summed up in one line. The great books cannot be summed up, you know, in one line. So the idea of the search for meaning, you know, which is never fully understood, has been a constant in my life. After finishing my book, I got very interested. I had gone to church for a year, which sometimes was like a big drag, I have to say. My husband said we should call the book "I Don't Want to Go to Church," not like I want to go to church, because I would get up, I would hear the buzzer, I would get up and I would go. And my daughter too would sometimes say to me, like, you know, "Mommy, I'm just not that religious. You know, do I have to go?" You know, she just really didn't like going. I mean, sometimes she would like it and sometimes she wouldn't. But I really got into the transcendentalist after I finished the book. I read Walden, and then I got on Margaret Fuller, who was the female transcendentalist. If you don't know about her, she's a wonderful writer. And the Peabody sisters, the writings of Elizabeth Peabody, you know, specifically. There's a great a book, you know, sort of a joint biography of the Peabody sisters, which I really loved. Of course, Emerson and Thoreau, but really particularly the journals of Hawthorne, the American journals of Nathaniel Hawthorne. And if people have not read them, they are so beautiful. There's a beautiful excerpted one that you can get, you know, very cheaply on the web, and it's I'm kind of dense when it comes to religion. I can't understand anything unless it's really embodied in narrative, because I'm, you know, that's why I became a writer, right? Because I can only understand things really in story form. So his journals and his, like, incidental writing about his life, you really can start feeling what transcendentalist was, what the actual spirit was, and what it was to live in that time. And those have really meant a lot to me. And the idea of God being more fully, you know, fully integrated into human life, into everyday life. This was right after the book. This was an idea that I was very interested in. I continue to be. And it started continued the work that my book had, which was the idea of working out your own personal theology. You know, that you, it's up to you. You can't just sit in the pew and expect everything to be handed to you 1 hour a week, right? You have it in you to redeem yourself, whatever that means, and you need to get off your butt and do it, you know? And so that, I felt like the transcendentalists really understood that, and they meant a lot to me at this time. And the idea of holiness having to do with, you know, active thinking, the idea that holiness and thinking went together, was a transcendental idea that I took to like crazy. I think that's, I mean, I've felt, when I can say I've actually felt like divinity in my life, I would say the movement of the mind would be one of, you know, way up there, actually. Also, like, weirdly, rewriting. I feel like, how do I know how to rewrite? I mean, how do I know how to rewrite? It must be something coming that, you know, helps me make something better, right? To, like, you know, make something more precise and more clear. So the idea that nature is hardwired into us, and that, you know, we, divinity is us, basically. We are nature. You know, we are the greater world. We are God. This was an idea that has, you know, has really, you know, really, you know, been very taken with the last few years, and that the mystic does not escape the world but makes use of it. And then this is Emerson: the invariable mark of wisdom is to see the miraculous in the common. So, I mean, I think my book was a movement toward that, but my work has been to move toward that, you know, that much more. I have another quote from Emerson. "The effulgence of the universal reason shines through the rudest individual fact, and that in the same way, every individual human being can be illuminated by higher truths." So this idea that the church is an inward reality, not just an outer reality. It's an inward reality. This is an idea that I've really run with in the last few years, and that the life of God in human nature, the divine life in man, And you know, it's true. I've always had a very mixed relationship with church. You can see, you know, the actually church life. I mean, partly because of my father, partly because when I go to church, sometimes I am really, really bored. I mean, just really crazily, just bored out of my mind, you know. So I've had to find, but I'm not sometimes. Sometimes I love it, and I'm moved, and I love the singing, and I love the liturgy, and I love the sermon. But then other times I'm just really bored, you know. So I've had to feel like I've had to really work on my own to sort of jumpstart, you know, feeling of awe, and that, you know, that luminousness that you were talking about, like within my own life. So that, you know, that like original relationship between God and man in myself. And also through reading the Transcendentalists, I really realized that it wasn't, because when you hear about the Transcendentalists, you always think about hiking and that you're going to have to go in the woods and all this, and like you're going to have to spend a lot of time like hiking around. It's going to be like this big thing. And like when you actually read them, and you know, now that I've done like a nice, you know, I mean, I haven't read everything, but I've read a lot, I realized that it's not wilderness, it's wildness. It's that wild particle of divinity that they were really trying to propagate. They happened to find it in wilderness because that's where they were finding it. But like, you know, in some ways wilderness is secondary. I can find that kind of wildness, that particle of wildness, you know, in my own Brooklyn neighborhood, in New York City, like in any experience, you know what I mean? That idea of that shifting part of humanity, that shifting part of nature. You know, that wildness is so much more important than actual wilderness. So once I got that, then I could understand the Transcendentalists better, and I didn't feel like I had to go on long hikes with, you know, my backpack and all that. And through that, I started to understand, you know, that my relationship with nature sort of improved. I always sort of felt a little hostile toward nature. I've always been like sort of like, I'm very competitive, and I've always felt like kind of competitive with Jesus, for instance. Kind of competitive, and kind of competitive with nature too. I have felt really competitive with nature. So this helped me, you know, this idea that it wasn't wilderness that was this thing I had to worship and all this stuff, but it was actually wildness, and I was as much nature as a tree or a fox or whatever. So this helped me a lot to sort of understand my place in the universe and my place, you know, my divine place. This helped me, you know, a lot. So I started to feel not so much God's subject, but a part or a piece of the mystery of God. And I started to feel, and this was a very interesting feeling to have, I started to realize, and this may be like totally crazy, but that my memories were a part of the greater nature's, you know, of greater nature's memories. Like it was a piece of the whole. This was like a very beautiful feeling to have, I have to say, like very beautiful, but very real. I was really starting to feel this, you know. And you know, I'm like everybody else, on good days I can feel that, and then I have many months where I can't feel that at all. But it really started to seem very true that my own memories and my own life was a part of this bigger whole, but in a different way than I had thought before, in this transcendental framework, you know, not so much in a straightforward Protestant or Christian framework. And this quote, and this idea reminds me of another person I really admire, who is Eleanor Roosevelt. I don't know if you've, I'm sort of obsessed with Eleanor Roosevelt. I'm always reading books about her, and I just am crazy for her. And she has said, this is a famous quote, but somehow or other, human beings must get a feeling that there is in life a spring that flows for all humanity. And I think this is what I was able to finally feel, this idea of not just my own, you know, my own sort of natural, you know, part of nature and part of being a part of the greater thing, but that it was, you know, connected to everyone as well, connected to the greater world. So this idea of thinking of myself as part of God, and also that, you know, intellectual movement is God, it very much became part of my life and my journey and my prayer life. And again, I'm going to quote Emerson: a sentence in a book or a word dropped in conversation set free our fancy, and instantly our heads are bathed with galaxies. And that's, I think, what the Transcendentalists did for me, is they really showed me how close we always are to infinity. Like, we're so close to it. You know, all we need to do is feel it. We're so close to that, you know, idea, and that it can be triggered at absolutely at like any moment. So I see this as a progression for myself, because I felt, you know, before that holiness wasn't kept inside of a church. I knew that is in my book a lot, right? That's this, you know, sort of escaped, and it's in bars, and it's in costume jewelry, and all these other crazy places. But my idea then was sort of that it was out of the church, but it was still focused in spots. It's a very like pagan way to think in a way. Like, you know, it's sort of pagan to think that God's in the church even. And I mean, now that seems to me very much sort of like idol worship actually, you know, but then for me even to think that certain items are more holy than other items. And I've been really pushed now to think of holiness. I've been challenged to think of holiness as not just in moments in secular life or based on certain objects, but really being challenged to feel a sense of holiness all the time in everything, which I think is probably the natural movement, like of the person for me anyway, it's a natural movement for me, for a religious person, to feel like, you know, there aren't any like specific spots of dense holiness, that it really is spread evenly everywhere, and I just have to be, you know, the veil has to, you know, be removed so I can actually feel that. Like, you know, so that's a big challenge, though, I have to say. That's like, you have a lot of bad days, and that's hard. But I feel the calling to feel that way now, so I'm trying to move myself in that direction. So that all happened. That was like a year or two. And then the next thing that really happened, which was just last summer, I guess, or last spring, is I was talking to my daughter. And I was really trying to have a religious talk with her. She's 16 now, and we go to church sometimes. She's friendly with Sister Leslie. I mean, we've had lunch with, like, you know, the Episcopal bishop. I mean, she has had lots of like very interesting religious experiences. We recently saw Thich Nhat Hanh. She's seen lots, but I wanted us to do something more regular, whether that was reading some books together or because, you know, I feel like when she goes away from me, you know, life is really hard, and when she has low points, I want her to have something that she can really lean on, that she really knows. And I didn't feel like that was really true. I felt like she had more like the sort of, you know, bohemian cultural New York experience. I wanted to work on it more. So it was supposed to be the come to Jesus talk, basically, is what I'm saying. But what turned out happening was so fascinating, is she said to me, you know, she just really frankly said to me, her first thing she said to me is, I think Christianity is too jealous. It's too jealous. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And she says, well, it's just too jealous. It takes too much of a person. It tries to take everything they have. Which, you know, there's a sense that's true in a way. It's not necessarily a bad thing, though. That's the thing. But how do you explain that to your 16-year-old daughter, right? So then she said to me, and then the really sad part of the thing, which I hadn't known before, is she said to me, she admitted how frightened she had been by the proselytizing preachers on the subway in New York City as a little girl. And, you know, she'd been with me a lot of these times, and I had said to her, don't listen to them, the world's not going to end, we're going to move to the other side of the car. But she had seen a lot of them, which you do, like crazy people preaching, you know, really preaching in a really passionate way. And she just said to me, a religion that motivates people to do that can't be sound. She just very frankly said that. She had sort of decided this, I feel like. You know, it was very sobering. And then she said to me, she was interested in Buddhism. Her school was studying, you know, history class, they were talking about, she has this incredible history teacher last year, and they talked about why some ideas move so quickly, both like why people liked salt so much and how that traveled, you know, how trade with salt, but they also talked about Buddhism and how easily Buddhism has traveled as an idea without really very much violence, you know, which is extremely rare, you know. So she was very interested in this idea that Buddhism is this thing that, you know, this powerful idea that can travel very easily. So she said, help me to study Buddhism. So the come to Jesus talk ended up with me helping her to study Buddhism. So we've done that. So we went to see Thich Nhat Hanh. We're going to try to go around and see some of the, like, the more interesting Buddhist teachers. We've been to the Shambhala Center in New York City. We're just a couple times a month. Like, we try to move in that direction. You know, we've read some stuff together. So that really has helped me, because I've never really been that interested in Buddhism. Partly because I felt like, you know, everybody has their Buddhist phase. I'm just not going to have mine. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, you know, like I always remember, like the rock band, the Smiths, that we're not going to go to America because everybody goes there. And like, I kind of felt the same way. Like, I'm just not going to do Buddhism. I'm just not going to do it. But I have to say, through this, I have gotten really, really interested in Buddhism. And so, you know, so my most recent, you know, interest in study has been specifically Trungpa. I've been fascinated with Trungpa, the Buddhist teacher who most famously got by accident into the cab with with the poet like Allen Ginsberg, and through that he influenced all the beats. He started Naropa University in Colorado. And his book, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, that is a book, man. If you guys, I mean, it's, I can't believe that anybody wouldn't like it. It's an amazing book. It's beautifully written, which is something I really demand. I can't read crappy New Age writing. You know, I will not read it, you know. And it is really good. It's almost like, I don't know if people here, you know, how much they know about literary fiction, but it's almost like a Mary Gateskill novel. It's like the states of mind are so carefully detailed that you can't, you read a paragraph and you're like, you just described how the, you know, how the math works, like, you know, actually in my mind, you know. So that's a beautiful book. I think The Myth of Freedom is also good. He's written many, many books. So I read him all this summer. That's been, I had a huge Trungpa thing this summer. And then you know, I'm gonna talk about his ideas in a minute, but then I've been trying to bring it back now a little bit too by reading Thomas Merton's Asian Journals to try to sort of combine some of the Buddhist ideas back with some of the Christian ideas. But so the ideas from Trungpa that I've been most interested in have been, you know, just really a continuation of transcendentalist ideas, the idea that wisdom is a domestic affair, that the mystical power can only be expressed through an extraordinary direct relationship with what is happening with reality. You know, so that's an idea that's, you know, very transcendental in a way. And he really encourages people also to stop their struggle to get a hold of a spiritual state. And that's what cutting through spiritual materialism is about. And that really spoke to me, because that's a lot of struggle, a lot of like, you know, am I moving forward? Am I making progress? Do I feel closer to God than I did before? You know, so the idea of just stop it. Just get sick of that, and just, you know, sort of stay where you are. That idea has been very helpful to me. He also has a traditional, you know, Buddhist idea, but he describes it very beautifully about working with root energy, you know, rather than laying over conceptualizations. You know, you feel angry, but before you even say you feel angry, you try to sort of figure out what that first feeling is that you're having, you know, without putting on something on it that you've learned from the culture at large. So you really work with the root energy. And his idea is if you can work with that root energy before you have to sort of name it or classify it, it can actually become a positive force in your life. It's not, you know, it doesn't lead you so much to like fixed ideas and negativity. Here's a quote from the book. To transcend aggression, passion, to transmute aggression, passion, ignorance, one must be able to communicate with energy directly and completely without strategizing. So this is an idea that has been very helpful to me. I'm not sure if I can really do it, but it's been a very challenging idea, you know, to me. And that, you know, the energy itself, to me, is wildness, is God, is the life force itself. So to have like a new relationship with that is very, very challenging to me. And this, it kind of speaks to an idea that I've, you know, often had myself as a little girl. I can remember thinking to myself, like, I always had the feeling that God was very raw, like sort of unevolved. And so that to have a relationship with God was so complicated because, like, in some ways it's sacrilegious to say, because, like, how can we be more evolved than God? But something that's so fundamental, like, how do you have a relationship with that? But that idea that God is unevolved and therefore cannot be apprehended by the senses, and so God exists as the witness of what is, and also as light and of energy. This is an idea that like made a lot of sense to me, and this idea has really like informed my prayer and my meditation life as well. I started by praying or meditating by feeling like I was separate from God. I was like God's subject, and I would pray up. I still have a tendency to do that, I have to say. It's not up, it's in or it's out, you know. But this whole idea that's not really the right way to be anchored to it. And this has a Christian back, you know, has a Christian idea too, the idea that, you know, Adam and Eve were one with God and they were thrown out of the garden, and then, you know, what we're all trying to do is get back, right? Is get back to some sense of, you know, to get back into the garden. So now when I pray, I feel like I'm more trying to unite. I'm trying to sort of take my place, you know, back in the universe. And not that I'm separate, you're not praying for peace, you know, to a separate God, but that I'm trying to unite myself back with the universe, to take my place, to like rest in God, that, you know, that I have a place. And that's, you know, that kind of brings us back to Rosa Parks, right? That's where like she had a place in the universe and she knew it, right? And she wasn't going to give it up. She was going to protest to not give it up, right? Because I feel like that's a lot of, you know, a lot of religious, you know, life is about understanding that we have a rightful place, that we have a rightful place in this world. And it's a place within God. And to feel that we're, you know, we're a part of nature and we're, you know, we're centered. We're centered in the world in the way, you know, in a very intrinsic way that we need to be. And this brought me back to a quote by Thomas Merton, on which is, man seeks to reconstruct that unity, which the predominance of one or other of the features of his character has broken or threatens to demolish. So this idea that we God's always with us, we're always one with God, but we feel like we're separate, right? So like through our character, we feel that we're separate. So that your prayer life can be a place where you take your place again. So this idea of the Buddhist idea, you know, of having a, you know, direct interaction with reality, and to deal with reality, and to be, you know, to be there in the moment. So all these ideas have been the ones that have been sort of swirling around me recently. But what has come about because of this most recently is it has been a little bit alarming to me, because I've really realized, and this has come really through meditation, through prayer, through thinking, in my quieter moments. It's made me wonder, because you know, the idea of the loving God has always been very important to me. As I'm a minister's daughter, you know, I did now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to, ever since, you know, the whole idea of the loving God. But it's really made me question in the last year or so if the concept of the loving God isn't hurting my connection with God. Which I don't know what to say. This might sound crazy too. I don't know if I'm just losing my mind, but like I have really felt that the idea that I've had for so long of the loving God may be somehow hurting my, you know, hurting that direct relationship that I need to have with the world and with reality and with life itself. I mean, maybe that's not unlike praying to a God that's above me, you know, that, you know, like, you know, maybe taking my place in the world and the universe means really letting go of that idea of the loving God. Now, I don't know if this is true or not, and I don't want anyone to give up their loving God, because it's a little bit like giving up your teddy bear or something. It's like terrible. Or your Bobo, your pacifier. My daughter used to call her Bobo. But I have actually thought about this, and it makes me, I feel very sad sometimes and sort of panicked as well. And I feel like I finally decided that, because I was panicked and thinking about it, and I talked to Sister Leslie about it, a few people about it. And finally what I've decided is if it happens, it's going to happen. I don't have any, I can't, it's just like, I mean, it's weird to say it's God's will, but I have no choice. Like, if this concept, like, completely fragments for me and I have to go to a new place, I'm going to have to do that. But, and I feel it may be happening. I don't know for sure. I don't know if I should long to let go of the concept of the, you know, the loving God, or if I should cling to it, but it's going to happen one way or the other. So I just need to sort of go along my way. So I have more to say, but I thought that I would stop now for questions. I want to talk a little bit about William James at the end. That's been my last point that I've been, the last few months, I've been very, very interested in William James. So I want to talk a little bit about him at the end if we have time. But I don't want to talk the whole time. I want to make sure we have time for questions. So let's see if there's any questions at this point. Please. Oh, sure. Oh, sorry.
You talked about your exposure to Buddhism and your development and your exploration of that with your daughter, but I was wondering if you had had any conversations or done any work about other, like, Abrahamic religions, either Islam or Judaism, on this other, like,
you know,
Central Park,
yeah,
journey.
Yeah, I'm very interested in. I've had Judaism, and that comes and goes, because I have friends that are rabbis, and we have discussions, and I love. I'm Rabbi Heschel. I don't know if people have read The Sabbath. That's an amazing, amazing book. I love the Baal Shem Tov. What a genius the guy was. Yeah. I have a few people like in the Hasidim that I love. Not so much really like, you know, with Islam. I would like to do more though, to be honest. I mean, my main contact with Islam now is cab drivers. Is when I think I'll ask them questions. I'll see that they are probably ask them questions, and I get information from them. But you know, I've read a little bit, you know, but not as much as I would like to. I definitely would like to do more on that. Like definitely. Please.
Please stand up when you ask your question.
Okay.
You mentioned a rightful place in this world.
Uh-huh.
Could you elaborate on what that looks like, or what that's looked like for you, or what that means?
Wow, that's a big question. I think that's, in some ways, I feel like, you know, we are already what we're supposed to be. I mean, I hope it doesn't sound like metaphysical, like gobbledygook, but like, it's about really, you know, accepting that you already are who you need to be. You already are a part of God. You already, you know, are a part of the earth. But I think to feel that is hard sometimes. It's hard not to feel like separate and a lot of longing and a lot of desire and a lot of confusion and right? A lot of shame just for being alive. It's so strange. But to me, the religious journey has gotten, I have periods of dryness like everybody, but it's gotten very, in the last year or so, maybe because of my daughter, it's gotten very, you know, like, you know, energized again, mostly with this idea, the idea of like, you know, I have a place. I have a place in this world. I mean, I sort of always knew that my work is important and my life was important. But even in just a really ordinary, you know what I mean? Like, everybody has a place in this world. And to, like, inhabit it fully, really inhabit it fully, you know? And know that the ideas that come to you, that thinking is holy, the ideas that come to you for a reason. You know, they come because they need to be, you know, like, brought out and developed, you know? You have no idea who's waiting. It may be your professor waiting to read your paper, you know? I've been very moved by my students' work at times. Like, it may be, a greater audience. You publish something more widely. You don't know who's waiting for that message. You have no idea, you know? And you don't know where that message is. You know, I was talking to the MFA students the other day, and you know, everybody wants to publish a book and all this, which is really important. But, yeah, I was saying that as a 12-year-old girl in Roanoke, Virginia, reading, like, the celebrity profile of Cher, meant more to me than, like, you know, a million Little Women. You know, it meant so much to me. It meant so much to me, you know? So you don't know who's waiting, you know, who's waiting for that. You know, like, you know, like, your place in the world has to do not just, like, you know, with, like, I have a rightful place, but also that, you know, movement, the movement that your own mind's going to make to connect to other people and whatnot. I mean, again, I can't help thinking about Rosa Parks, you know? I mean, she did this small thing, but think about, my God. You know, think about what happened because of that. You know, it's incredible. Just incredible. Who else? Please.
Thank you. A lot of what you've talked to us about in your book itself has talked about this personal inquiry into the divine and what it really means to you. And I was wondering if you ever felt that there was a limit to this inquiry, because it almost sounds like with your own thoughts towards a loving God, it's sometimes driven by something outside of yourself entirely, and you don't really have control on it.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that there are certain limits to this that you'll take, or certain things that maybe God wouldn't want you to inquire into, or do you ever feel any limitations?
I don't really believe that God wouldn't want you to inquire into certain things. I mean, I think that's the weird thing about, you know, when you actually start on the serious religious path, at least for me. I remember, you know, my work with Sister Leslie. It's when I really realized that, I mean, I had just gone through a divorce, and I really realized that my divorce was this beautiful second chance. It's life, you know? And that, in a way, because I was feeling sad and guilty like everybody, I felt terrible. It took me years to decide to do it and that. But even that idea, I think this happens to a lot of people. When bad things happen to them, supposed bad things, they feel this incredible spiritual thing come. And that's really what gets a lot of people interested in the spiritual life at those times, is that you know something that's supposed to be bad isn't actually bad. But I feel like that's the thing. Like I realized that Sister Leslie, she could care less really what, like, it was all about the movement of the spirit. If something was really bad or good, could care less. Like, she really wanted to know about what you were feeling, what you were thinking, if it was dirty, if it was wrong, if it was bad, didn't matter. You should explore it. It's who you were. You were a human being. You know, it's the movement of the spirit. You got to check it out. So I don't know. I haven't felt any limits sometimes. I do have, like, periods of dryness where ideas kind of seem stale, or I'm not feeling it, and I feel like, you know, maybe I'm just not, this isn't going to be going on anymore for me. But then something always happens, and I get excited again about something. And But I mean, it is work. I have to, you know, I look for books that I'm interested in, and I seek out people and ideas that I'm interested in, and I try to let the, I mean, I hate to say I try to let the spirit move me, but I sort of do. Like if I see someone that looks interesting to me, I know there's a reason why that person has something that I may need to like examine or, you know, or think about. So I think that is the beauty actually of the, you know, of, you know, the spiritual life, is I don't really think there is any end. There is no end point. I think it's wrong to think there is an end, that you've decided, you're done, you've chosen your dogma, you're there, it's, this is it. I think that's, to me, that's not a spiritual life personally that I would want to have anyway, you know. Go ahead.
It seemed like towards the end of Easter Everywhere, you kind of released the church of its responsibility as kind of this sole, really concentrated place of worship,
uh-huh.
and just saw the sacred in so many things.
Uh-huh.
Has this allowed you sort of, I don't know, what's happened? Has there been fellowship in many places with many objects, with many uh-huh. things? Have you found that since
you've done it? That's true. I think I have less and less. I mean, I used to feel like, and I still feel like this to a certain extent, that I should really go to church, you know, and I do go to church, you know, I do things that I consider like traditionally religious as much as I can, but I have really always felt, because of my background, that I should be a member of a church, I should, you know, put money in the collection plate, I really need. But for me, that really hasn't worked out. I've never really been totally comfortable in like a church setting. So for me, it has been a real gift to be able to, you know, both have, like I have a girlfriend, and we recommend each other religious books, and then we go and have wine and we talk about them like crazy and everything, you know. It's like, so I have a lot of things like that in my life where, you know, I have friends that are sort of, we both have, you know, interests in different things, and that, you know, leads us to spiritual fellowship. And I mean, I think I'm mixed, because on the one hand I feel like the dinner party is just, I mean, a good dinner party, and you know, can be just as good as any church service as far as communion and you know, talking about things, and I mean, even talking about books. I mean, I feel so lucky to teach novels, because I feel like that's the best communion I've ever had, ever, no matter in anything, is talking, like, seriously about a book with somebody. Like, that makes community like nothing else. Like, I sometimes, like, think that that's why books exist, is so people can meet and have communion over them. I mean, it's just so incredible. But I don't know, but then on the other hand, I really like the idea of the church, because you're not gonna invite everybody to your dinner party. Like, that, those people are chosen for their talents, you know, sometimes for their socioeconomic. So I love the idea of the church that includes everyone. There's a wide variety of people. You know, in my book, I go to a church in my neighborhood. There are many people that were not like me. I'm still friendly with many of those people. So it's, I don't know, it's hard. It's hard to get that feeling of, you know, that feeling of where, you know, everybody comes, what social class, what race, comes like equally to a place. I mean, that is a beautiful thing about a church, which is hard for me to give up, you know, on completely. I think that's a beautiful thing, you know. Please go ahead.
I'd like to know a bit more, hear from you about what moved you to write. Well, not that would be, I guess the answer would be the Holy Spirit, but why did you write Easter Everywhere at the time when you wrote it, uh-huh. and what did audience have to do? How uh-huh. did you sort of envision or think of audience as you developed your voice
uh-huh.
in writing in that style? Because an autobiographical uh-huh. voice tends to be different from a novelist's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And how was that also perhaps part of your also spiritual growth?
Mm-hmm. Well, I decided to write, I wanted to tell, I had changed a lot. I'd gone through a divorce, and I had this big sort of spiritual interest, and I decided that I wanted to tell myself my life story again, like right at the point where I was, which I guess I was, at that point I was probably 42 or something. And I wanted I feel like it's the same reason people like sometimes will decide to go back into therapy. Like, they want to reshift. Like, they had one narrative view of their life, and now things have changed, and they have to tell themselves their life story now in a new way, right? So I wanted to do that about, you know, about my own life. So I decided, and I wanted to, you know, sort of take back some of my early religious experiences, you know, being a minister's daughter, and you know, be in that place again, as well as, you know, I really did have a, I would walk past this church every day that I went to, Grace Reformed, and I really would have I felt a strong draw toward it. I mean, maybe it was just, you know, depression or loneliness, but I would really feel it. And there's lots of churches in the neighborhood, but I would really feel it, you know. And so that was part of it too. I wanted to explore this church. I wanted to sort of sink into my neighborhood more deeply. So the things all came together, and I just, you know, I decided that it was time to move to nonfiction. And it was much different than writing a novel in that I wrote it faster, and I knew the parts I wanted to write about. I had lots to write about, which I don't always like. Sometimes I have to. It's hard for me to build my novels slowly. I build my novels much more slowly. And it was a spiritual experience. Yeah, I mean, definitely. Like I got to revisit. I got to really cherish my early life. I think in a way that I didn't necessarily. I thought about my father a lot. He's been a very interesting, you know, spiritual kind of conundrum in my life. He's a wonderful man, but his message has been a complicated one in a lot of ways. So yeah, I don't know if that answers the question. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
In your own writing, did you ever feel like you were, your ideas were all God-given, or was it sometimes you felt like you were fighting those ideas, and how did you like separate them in your mind or anything?
That's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's tricky because, you know, I think sometimes when I say that ideas come from, like, you know, from God or from nature. It's really like it isn't really as metaphysical as it sounds, because it's sort of like, you know, we are nature, and so, you know, of course an idea that we had would be a part of the natural process, just like the seasons turning or whatnot, right? So it's like that, you know, that big idea of God, that big natural idea of God. I mean, I always tell my writing students who are so worried about form, they're always obsessed with form, and they always feel like form is going to hit them on the head like a brick, and then they're going to know exactly how to form their stories. But like I always say, like you have to think to yourself that, you know, look at nature. Like, look how beautiful a shell is. Look how beautiful a leaf is. You know, even ugly things in nature are beautiful. They find a form. And if you're faithful long enough to that material and you shape it up, you will find a form, just like forms find themselves in nature, you know? But I don't know. So I guess I definitely feel like sometimes when I have an idea or I feel that movement, which I feel is in my life, is definitely grace, you know. It definitely doesn't feel like it's all me. Like I feel like it does come from, you know, whatever it is. It comes from God or from, you know, like I said, wildness, you know, like, you know, the movement of life itself, the energy of life itself. I definitely feel that. I mean, of course, you know, I feel like my better ideas are ones that I tend to obsess on and I think about. I mean, when I want jelly beans, I don't necessarily think that that's like necessarily from God, you know. You know, when I want to eat a hamburger, but like, you know, but there are some of my ideas I have, I do feel like they have a lot of force behind them, and especially if they stick with me, if I find myself daydreaming about them, if I find myself wanting to read things on that subject and work in my journal, then I know that's something that I am meant to, that's partly why I'm here. I'm meant to bring that idea out somehow, like in the best way that I can, you know. Or, I feel like we should.
I really like this idea of the creative process as divine inspiration, uh-huh. as part of the spirit. And I was wondering if you'd ever found that sort of inspiration through music. It's a different form of creative expression.
You mean my music and when I was in my rock band? When I was in my rock band, Ruffian? What?
If either you're through your own production or through other artists.
I never really got to be a good enough musician. I shouldn't even say I play the guitar because it's so rudimentary that it's like unbelievable. But yeah, I think music definitely. I mean, I've always been really jealous of music because I feel like it's the best art form, really. Even though I love writing, but I feel like music can reach people in ways that is just so unbelievable and so moving without having to have a lot of specific thematic ideas or a lot of, I mean, it has precision, but in a totally different way that's not sort of image connected. And so, sure, I mean, yeah, I love music. Like, definitely, yeah. Did you have a question? Go ahead. You just go ahead.
Kind of spawning off of Professor Warren's question about sort of putting together your thoughts in this memoir, how, do you go about articulating a story like this to multiple audiences, uh-huh. and especially since the book is very well thought to reach people who maybe might be questioning their faith or
right.
who are going through a similar path, and mm-hmm. I personally find myself all the time being in the process of being ordained in a church to articulate my call to different sorts of people I encounter all the time.
Right.
And I thought it was really interesting how you sort of really put it into a tangible, accessible kind of form. And like you said, a narrative form that really can sort of reach different audiences.
Yeah.
I just want kind of to know what your thought process was for that.
Well, I mean, it's all like really all I know. Yeah, I'm not really like, I haven't been trained in theology or anything like that. So I don't really know how to do it besides tell my own experiences and my own story. But I think it is really tricky because I feel like I definitely wanted to write my book for a secular audience. I felt like, my book is strange because I feel like it's in some ways not religious enough for like really religious people, but it's too religious for people that are secular. So it kind of goes into a very strange place in a way, you know. But I think it's important. I think we're having a big problem in America right now, having writers that don't seem to want to communicate religious ideas to like a secular audience. Like we had Merton. I mean, we had all these great writers in the 50s and 60s that could really do it. Dorothy Day, we had Merton, we had Dorothy Day. And now it's not the same as it was, I feel like. And I feel like it's really important to get these, you know, in order for a growing intellectual interest in religion and a feeling that it's not just a right-wing born-again thing, you know. But I think it's important to have try to have a conversation. And so I really wanted my book to be that. I really didn't want to just like use language that would, you know, sometimes even sometimes when I read books and I see language that is too religious, I'm very turned off because it just seems like cliche to me. Like the metaphors they're not fresh. I don't know what the person really means. I mean, my Holy Spirit and your Holy Spirit. I mean, that's just like, wow. I mean, that'd be so different. How would you ever be able, you know what I mean? So I really did try to bring it right home so I could explain my experience. I was hoping that through that, and a big model for me really is Thomas Merton. I just adore that guy. You know, I've read all of his journals. I've read basically everything he's written, and he's such an amazing writer. And I feel like his writing of what his interior life was like and the honesty that he was able to talk about is very meaningful to me. And so I did sort of model my own religious ideas on that, like on the way that he was very frank. He would use his own, examples from his own life. He would bring in, not afraid to bring in other things, not afraid to talk about doubt a lot. So that definitely was a model for me as I was working on the book. Oh, please. Oh.
Yeah. So maybe part of the angst underlying this question is the fact that you're disrupting my proverbial teddy bear, aka the loving God. But I can't let you get away without talking about that a bit more.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, could you articulate why would the thought or belief or aspect of a loving God disrupt this process for you or the process that you've been going through? So.
Well, you know, it's a big question, and if we should really just like go have a drink because it's that kind of a question, really. But the it would take like several hours of like, but it's about through some of the reading and through this, the Buddhist reading, the idea of like trying to deal with reality, which means you're not going to lump a lot of preconceived ideas on things, like what holiness means, right? Like what God means. The loving God is, even though it's positive and it's been helpful to me, it still is starting to seem like a preconceived idea that was, that was given to me as a girl, right? And I've used it a lot, but I haven't really thought about it a heck of a lot, really. Like, it was sort of giving to me, God loves you, your guardian angel is up there, God loves you. Like, and it's something that I think it may be time for me to think about. I mean, particularly because I think in my life, a God that's like both, like, I don't think God, in my life, God, like, the idea of God has been the most meaningful and has rattled me the most when it hasn't just been like loving or good. When it's been like, I always say to people if we're talking about the Bible, like, there's a reason why when the angels came, the first thing they said was, be not afraid, right? Because like, they had eyes and their hair, and they were like scary. They weren't like little cherubic, holly hobby thing. They were scary. And I think that the force of holiness is not totally positive. Like I said, it can be very disruptive in people's lives. It's not a totally positive thing. I mean, I think to think that God only wants what's good in human terms is crazy. I mean, I think that's crazy. We don't really know what God's work is for us. I mean, that's where the mystery part comes in. You know, whole, you know, God and the mystery of life. We don't really know. And I think that in my own life, it's a bracketed place, you know, maybe for me, this idea of the loving God, you know. But I'm not saying that I give it up like I'm going to give it up. It's like I don't really want to give it up. And I still, before, when I was in my little room at the Colonnade Club, I was like, loving God, please, you know, make me do a good job on my lecture. You know what I mean? I'm still right there. You know, it's like, but I'm just saying that it's become more of a question. I'm more open to it, which I think, to be honest, is kind of positive. That I'm more like, you know, open to the idea of God as a different sort of, you know, like a more open, not necessarily good, you know, more open, bad and good, life force, energy, wildness, force. And not so much this idea, you know, like, you know, only of the loving God. Does that help at all, or what?
Do those have to be mutually exclusive?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. I have to say I don't know that. You could, if you bring me back in 2 years, I may be farther along then. I don't know. I don't really know, you know. I also think, I worry that it's very easy to be like, you know, God loves you. You know, and I also have lots of memories of like bad. I have some memories of bad theology, like being around ministers when I was little. And I can remember several times, like not my father ever, but just stupid ministers saying to, you know, women whose kids had died, you know, God, you know, needed a rosebud for his garden or something. I'm like, you know, fuck you. I mean, that's just like, you know what I mean? So I saw a lot of the loving God just being like really manhandled in a way that was totally uncool, you know, like, so that's another thing to think of. I wonder about that, the idea, this concept. It's a human concept. It's not, the loving God is not God's concept. It's a human, it's a human construct, you know, different for each one of us, right? But, so I don't know. I don't know what the question is to this one. I don't really know. I don't know. Yeah, please.
I hate to follow the teddy bear question, but I wanted to just follow up on something you said, especially about the unknowable mystery of God, and that you described yourself as a kind of armchair theologian, which I just thought was a really interesting phrase. But I wanted to ask, what then is the role of comprehensive religious traditions? You know,
it's a good point.
As somebody who would hold to one of those, are we missing it?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I think it's. I mean, I'm totally. You know, if there weren't for all the, you know, one, the his, you know, the wonderful histories of, you know, I've read Aquinas, you know, all the, you know, the incredible Catholic. I mean, I was at a reading of, who was it? It was an older American novelist. I'm not gonna be able to remember his name, but he said something like, "I don't care anything about religion, and I would never read any Judaism or Christianity." I'm just like, are you crazy? Like, people have worked so hard on this big question, and you're not even going to read any of the books? I mean, that to me is just so stupid, you know? It's like, and I think that it's, you know, it's because of the desire and the longing in the world that these traditions came up. I mean, they're, you know, in general, it's a beautiful thing that people have tried to work together to figure out shared ideas about God and whatnot. Though I would encourage you within that to do, you know, to try to do your own thing too, you know, to have your own, that you're, you know, to really feel like your own journey and your own search and your own sort of, your own, that you're responsible for your own religious life and for your own spirituality. You know, I would encourage you to really take that journey yourself as well. But I don't think it has to be done separate from, you know, from a religious tradition. Not at all. I mean, not at all. Let's have, people haven't asked questions first and then, sorry. Please, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm gonna go back to the teddy bear thing real
quick. Okay, go, yeah.
I think what he wants, I'm guessing, but I guess I'm wanting maybe like an example. So like, what would that look like practically to say like, that we don't know, like, you don't wanna believe in a loving God because you can't really decide where God is actually working. It could be disruptive.
Right.
Like, I mean, practically, like, could you look at a horrible situation and say, well, that very well could be God? Or do you wanna say that certain things aren't God at all? Because on one hand, you have like the cheesy God
that's
sort of saying.
Yeah, I don't feel like I can really say what's God. I mean, I do think I get a feel for when things are just downright evil, sure. But I think that's very rare. That's like,
that's like
10, you know, 0.00% of. I mean, I think evil behavior is really rare. Though I do believe in evil, but I think I don't really think it's up for us to judge almost any situation. I mean, I think history has kind of showed this over and over again. You know, as far as, you know, politics and wars and whatnot. Like we, you know. I don't think there's really is like the idea of a God, you know, like a USDA God-approved situation. I think it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah,
I think it's very. I think it's also very, like, I've come to think myself that for me to decide, oh, well, it's God's will, that's like, it's very, it's kind of immature of me spiritually, I feel like, to think that. I felt that, you know, recently I felt that, definitely.
Okay.
But go ahead with your questions. You seem like you...
Well, I don't know. I guess I just keep thinking about my
own. I'm sorry I've upset you guys, though. I feel bad now. I feel really bad. I feel really bad now.
I mean, I've had experiences...
That's not what I meant to do. I mean, maybe a little bit like evoke and disturb, but not really like make sad. You know what I mean? Like.
I guess I was trying to think about, you know, situations that have happened politically or socially where people have sort of told me, well, that was God's sovereignty making that happen.
Yeah.
And so when you say... You don't want to say, like, sort of name who God is or that God has to be love. I worry about those people. We can then look at those sort of awful situations and say, well, that was part of God's plan, too. Like, this evil, like, God wanted to happen. And that, too, could be, I mean, this is good. This is fine. And I don't really like that either.
Well, but it's shaking. Like, again, I know I've been talking
a lot. Am I making any sense, by the way?
No, yeah, okay. Totally. But I want to, but, you know, like, the civil rights movement is, I think, a great example of this where, I mean, I was always so moved, and I have, it's, My husband's also very like interested in the civil rights movement, and we read The Children together, and we talked about all the books and everything. And he's very secular. He's probably agnostic. He might even be an atheist actually. But I've always loved the civil rights movement, partly because they would start at the church, right? They start at the church, they pray, then they go on their march. It's not like they're like going around in their, you know, clown wigs with their painter pant overalls. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it has a root in the spiritual life, and I think. They didn't pray saying, we know we're right, God. You know what I mean? Like, let us win. They prayed saying, we don't know. We feel moved to do this thing. And that's different than it's necessarily even God ordained. You know what I mean? It's a very pedantic.
Maybe we should grab that drink at a certain point. that's helpful, though. That's helpful.
That's a little bit of an example.
I'll email you or something.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's fine. There was a question. Oh. I have a question, yeah, please. Oh, go ahead, please.
But along the same lines of, like, the loving God, I think what concerns me is that, like, you lean on the church and you lean on God for comfort, like, when you're in those bad situations. And I think the idea of the loving God is more of a comfort thing rather than, like, a theology thing. So
yeah,
I don't know
you might be right. And that's a very smart thing to say. I think that what we might be getting to is that the church hasn't always been loving, though, sadly. But this church... and is not loving a lot, I mean, at least part of the time anyway, but the church can be a very comforting and loving atmosphere for people. But I don't know if that means that God is exclusively a loving God. I don't know if that's true anymore. That's what I'm saying to you guys today. I don't know. But I agree with you that the church, at its best, I mean, I like churches that are like, I mean, I will go to church sometimes when I'm at different, if I'm like away from my home, I'll go. And I've seen some amazing churches that they're almost like the French Resistance. You know, they'll be like I was near where my mom lives in Albany. I just randomly went to the like Methodist church that was near her, and there were a bunch of families that had just come from India, and then there were these old people, but they were like seemed like old white people, like they were on their little. But they all seemed like they seemed so happy to be together, and like it was fantastic. You know, I loved it. It seemed like a very like loving and positive place. You really could feel something going on there, you know. So I think it can really happen. The church can be, you know, amazing place of community, you know. So, oh, go ahead, please.
So thinking about just where you talk about like the transcendentalists and everything, and you know, really good stuff there, like becoming a piece of the mystery of God and. Like the wildness of divinity and everything. I was just wondering if you could talk maybe about, so the transcendentalist a lot is about truth and the connection to that being like this eyeball that's seeing like truth directly. But what about like the Christian lens that can be applied to that, like or sort of in your experience?
Can you be a little more specific?
Just in your study of like transcendentalists, how did that reflect on your Christian faith and sort of that particular
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That particular interpretation of the mystery of truth or everything out there.
I'll try. I part of my interest in in the Transcendentalists, I think, is that they were a lot of, you know, they were former, you know, they're all former ministers, like, you know, Emerson is a former minister. And so I really, like, the idea of, like, the minister that's decided not to be a minister anymore, that to me is, like, I love that. Like, that's my best. Like, I always love, like the idea of the minister that's on the edge, sort of like the junkie slash minister. That's, like, my favorite kind of character. But that I feel like the Transcendentalists are in that pocket where, I mean, you guys, you probably know this, that what was happening at that time is that finally a lot of the mystic texts were translated into German so they could finally be read, some of the Eastern texts. And that's really why we have Transcendentalism, is that the mind was blown, like their minds were blown by some of these Eastern ideas, some of these Buddhist ideas. Like, they finally got to read the Bhagavad Gita and they finally got to read some of these books. So that idea of, like, a more expansive idea of what God was, that God wasn't only involved with the old church, you know, there was new things you could do yourself in the moment. That's the thing that I like the book, you know, best about it. And that really came about partly because in my book, you know, I go to Grace Reformed and they're not really Pentecostal, but they definitely, like, it's very different, like, from my own, like, Lutheran upbringing, which is very, like, badly sung hymns and, like, a lot of, like, very strict, where they're, like, you know, they're whipping it up, they're praying. And if you've ever heard West Indian Americans pray, I mean, they can pray, like, they are fantastic at praying. Like, they just are great. Like, you could feel it, you know. And I realized they were trying to make something happen then. Like, they weren't happy just to, like, read prayers that were about something happening a long time ago, right? They were trying to make something happen mystical right then. And that, even though I didn't agree with it, I also felt like a little bit sometimes, like, it was like people that were always in the first stage of love, like, you know what I mean? They would never get out of that first, like, oh, I'm in love. Like, it seemed a little bit immature to me sometimes even. But the idea really excited me. And I think the reason that then I went to the Transcendentalists is because in their own way, in a way that was, fit better with who I am and my personality, like, they were trying to do the same thing. They were trying to make something spiritual happen right there in the moment, like with their involvement with nature, you know what I mean? Like, with their group talks, and that really, really spoke to me. Not something just in the church, but trying to make something happen right now. You know, right now, something that's filled with grace. Yeah, I think, yeah, yeah.
So still connected with, like, the Transcendentalist movement, like, yeah. You talked a little bit about the language of the church, and that's been a big theme in our class, and, like, I guess one thing in, like, Nature by Emerson, he writes that, like, words are finite organs of the infinite mind, and they can't properly address, like, what is truth. And, I guess just, like, how do you apply that to the language of the church, but also, like, as a novelist, like, using words as your medium to express infinite thoughts?
I know,
and
it's an endlessly challenging thing. I mean, I'm very interested in this idea, partly because I feel like that's part of where the mystery lies in writing, right? Is the idea that we have these preconceived, even like a chair. Well, you can say it's a chair, that's the name for it, but really it's this wooden thing that has a certain, you know what I mean? It's like, and I always think of, I have a friend that spent a lot of time in a thought deprivation tank, and he told me that when he came out, I know it's weird, right? But I do. And when he came out, he noticed that, like, the trees had, everything had an aura. You know what I mean? Trees had an aura, and, like, people had different auras, and, like different, like, you got a real feeling from different colors. And he started to realize that the reason we have to say, like, person, chair, house, is because, like, if we could see clearly, like, at the scale, like, you know, they talk about this in the Bible, if the scales could fall off of our eyes and we could really see the world, we would just be like, ah, tree, you know what I mean? Like, oh my God, like, you know, you'd have to stay there for like 20 years just like looking at the tree. So that whole idea of the name for the thing versus the glory of the thing, I mean, that is the challenge of writing, that you're always trying to make those negotiations, like, because you can't let the glory out for every single item that you describe, right? Because it would just be too boring, you know? But, like, you have to let the glory out in different ways, you know, as you're writing, or people wouldn't want to read, you know. So that's a huge challenge, I think, both in the spiritual life, like whether we're trying to talk about our spiritual life with people or even think about it ourselves, like putting names to things that have happened to us, or whether you're trying to describe something or write something in a book, definitely very challenging, very challenging. Go ahead.
In your book, I got the sense that you weren't blaming anyone. I don't know if that's true. If it is, was there a point in your life that you did blame your parents or your family or other people? And if you don't, then how do you not blame them anymore?
how do I not blame them anymore?
Yeah.
That's a big question. All right. No, I don't think I think, I mean, there have been times I'm old enough now where I see my parents as like wonderful but valuable people, and I mostly am grateful for my life in the church. I mean, I had a very strange upbringing in that I, you know, was a minister. I was sort of raised like a Victorian girl. Like I learned Latin and I had to memorize lots of the Bible and I was in church all the time. And I was always taught that our family was better than our financial means. You know what I mean? Like, so we were always living in this way where like, we're really, you know, we know Latin and we're intellectual, but we live in this crappy little ranch house, you know? But, so there was that feeling all the time. But I think that it's, I don't know. I mean, I think it's hard, you know? Your parents, the fact that you have to just deal with their lives, I feel like that's what I've come down to now. Just like, they give you their lives, kind of, and they're like, you sort of in some ways feel responsible for their life, the life they've lived, the choices they've made. And it can be really hard. You know, there's something really sad and hard about it sometimes. Just the fact that they've lived this life, they have these regrets, and you know what I mean? It's very complicated, you know? But I've tried, I mean, I think definitely through writing the book, I definitely tried to, you know, I have a lot of love for people in my family. I try to show that. Like if I try, you know, I tried to make myself the person who was searching and foolish and making mistakes, and I tried to show them, you know, with a wide variety of qualities. But it takes a long time, you know, it takes a long time to really be able to, you know, I don't know if you get any wiser in life, but you definitely get, like, I feel like I'm a little bit like, it's like I'm on horseback. You can see a little more of the terrain as you get older, you know what I mean? Like, I'm a little bit higher up on the horse now, and I can see, oh, okay, well, like, you know, you're not so fixated on people's wrongs and how they've wronged you. You can kind of see, like, in the distance a little bit more. And that's definitely helped me in coming to terms with my past life and my family. Is it time?
No, may I ask one final question?
Okay, sure, sure.
Maybe afterwards we can stick around.
Of course, of course, of course. I would love that, yeah.
But that makes me, the last point, we just want to ask quickly, I don't know if you've seen Patricia Hampel's little book, I Can Tell You Stories.
Yes, most definitely, yeah.
Great book about memoir.
Yeah.
She has a chapter called, like, Other People's Secrets, basically about the treachery of writing memoir.
Right.
And she says something like, you know, the parallel lines of memory and imagination clash and collide finally in narrative. The casualty is the body of privacy lying smashed on the tracks.
Mm.
And, what you just said makes me just want to ask what the fallout was, of your book with your family and friends and the secrets that you portrayed.
Yeah, no, there definitely was, my dad we had a few serious dinners, you know, where he would tell me things about his life. And I mean, luckily for me is when he had his shrink read the book, and the shrink's point of view was, Paul, this is an incredible opportunity for you. So I was just like, yes, this is fantastic. So he kind of treated it like that. It was hard for him, but he treated it like it. So that it turned out ultimately to be a positive thing. My mom was a little harder, but I think I read at St. Rose's College in Albany, and I read all the parts that make her look the best, and she was so happy. So that kind of like put that to rest. The hardest person in a way has been my dad. My dad has been married a bunch of times. He's got his third wife, and she's a lovely person, but it was hardest on her because the idea that she had of him didn't really fall into line with the guy in the book. So that was tricky. That was more tricky. I think she's maybe even now still a little bit, like that would be the one relationship that hasn't quite gotten back to normal yet. I read everything to Abby. Abby was like, I'm so funny. I said, she thought she was like, I love myself. She said to me, put more stuff in there about me. What about the other time when I blah, blah, blah. So she was no problem. So anyway, thank you so much. I have really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.